The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission is reporting Sunday that at least 34 people were killed in a bus attack in western Ethiopia on Saturday night. This comes as fear mounts of a security vacuum due to a military campaign in the north. The human rights body said the number of people killed was likely to rise after what it called a gruesome attack on the passenger bus. Meantime, the conflict between the Ethiopian federal government and Tigrayan forces in the north has escalated and now includes Eritrea. The Tigrayan forces fired rockets across the border into this neighboring country after claiming that the Ethiopian military was using an Eritrean airport as a base for attacks. Ethiopia's prime minister tweeted, though, that his country is more than capable of taking care of itself. Ethiopia's prime minister won the Nobel Peace Prize last year for making peace with Eritrea after tense relations following a border war 20 years ago. The Tigrayans say the two countries are now working together against them. Voters in Moldova head to the polls today for a second time to cast their ballot for president. Current leader Igor Dodon is running against challenger Maia Sandu. The president has the support of Russia. Sandu is a former World Bank economist who is pushing for closer ties with the West. The challenger finished ahead of the president in the first round of voting earlier this month, propelled ahead by a large surge in voting by Moldovans living abroad. The United Arab Emirates will extend its golden visa system, which grants 10-year residency in the Gulf state, to certain professionals, specialized degree holders, and others. That's what the UAE's vice president said on Sunday. Those eligible for the new visas include people with doctorate degrees, medical doctors, and also people with other specialty degrees in computer science and electronics. This is VOA News. China and 14 other countries agreed Sunday to set up the world's largest trading bloc, encompassing nearly a third of all economic activity, in a deal many in Asia are hoping will help hasten a recovery from the shocks of the pandemic. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership was signed virtually on Sunday on the sidelines of the annual summit of the 10-Nation Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The accord will take already low tariffs on trade between member countries, still lower over time. The pact does not include the U.S., which pulled out of a similar trans-Pacific trade deal shortly after U.S. President Donald Trump took office. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's incoming chief of staff on Sunday urged Congress to pass bipartisan pandemic financial aid as the number of new coronavirus cases shattered U.S. records and strained many state healthcare systems from coast to coast. Ron Klain, in an interview on NBC News' Meet the Press program, said such a bill was urgently needed given the surge in COVID-19 cases and that a relief package could pass before Biden took office on January 20th. Klain added that Biden's team planned to meet with Pfizer and other drug makers this week, but is still awaiting federal government authorization to formally begin transition efforts between his pandemic advisors and the White House Coronavirus Task Force. SpaceX, the rocket company of high-tech entrepreneur Elon Musk, was due on Sunday to launch four astronauts on a flight to the International Space Station. It's NASA's first full-fledged mission, sending a crew into orbit aboard a privately owned spacecraft. The company's newly designed Crew Dragon capsule, which the crew has dubbed Resilience, was set for liftoff atop a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket at 7:20 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S. from NASA's Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral, Florida. The 27-hour ride to the space station and orbiting laboratory some 250 miles above Earth was originally scheduled to begin on Saturday, but the launch was postponed for a day due to forecasts of gusty winds, remnants of Tropical Storm Eta, that would have made a return landing for the Falcon 9's reusable booster difficult. And that's what NASA officials are saying about the launch. And the United States set a new record of daily coronavirus infections with nearly 200,000 cases as the number of cases nears 11 million. Due to the record highs, the average daily increase of coronavirus infections in the U.S. has exceeded 132,000 over a seven-day period. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. With virtually all votes counted in all 50 states, former Vice President Joseph R. Biden was declared President-elect of the United States. The announcement was met with celebrations in cities across the country, but President Donald Trump and most Republicans refused to concede the election, claiming malfeasance affected the vote totals. Trump also sent shockwaves through the government by firing key administration officials in the Defense Department, including Secretary of State Mike Esper. The vacancies are being filled by Trump loyalists, some of whom have little or no experience with the department, fueling speculation about the motivation for the moves. President-elect Biden dismissed the Trump administration's refusal to begin the official transition process, even as key Republican leaders sided with President Donald Trump in his uphill legal fight to overturn Biden's projected presidential election victory. Meanwhile, the Biden transition team is being denied access to resources and information that may leave the U.S. vulnerable during and after the transition period. COVID-19 cases continue to ramp up in the United States, with record numbers for new cases being set daily. President-elect Biden named a coronavirus task force and pledged to refund the World Health Organization upon assuming office in an effort to bring the pandemic under control. And pro-democracy leaders in Hong Kong resigned in protest against the continuing suppression of democracy by the mainland Chinese regime. Panelists, welcome. We have much to talk about in what is maybe most extraordinary in modern times when we talk about the election and the things and the events that have happened afterwards. So let us get to it. 5 days after the polls closed, election results confirmed that Joe Biden will be the 46th president of the United States, defeating Donald Trump in his bid for re-election. The vote counts in Wisconsin and Arizona, Nevada and Georgia confirmed a Biden victory, but the president and lawyers for the campaign are suggesting that there were voting irregularities in those battleground states, despite statements from domestic and international observers that there was no evidence of a widespread conspiracy to commit voter fraud. Linda, I'm going to start with you. What are the facts about the vote counts here? Are the elections fair and accurate?
American elections are highly decentralized. There is national law that governs the elections, but there's also state law and even local differences. And that's important because it would be extraordinarily difficult for somebody to rig this election in such a widespread way as to overturn a legitimate result. So what we're seeing right now is election workers, officials, and others all across the country, especially in these final states that haven't been called, doing their due diligence, counting the ballots, counting the late ballots, the ballots that came in on time but have yet to be counted, and making sure that the result is accurate. This delay in getting the final result and in calling the final states has created this opening for Donald Trump to claim fraud. Now, as you say, there's no evidence of widespread fraud. Yes, you can find the stray case of a dead person who voted or maybe somebody who voted twice, but any kind of systemic widespread fraud that Donald Trump is claiming, there's absolutely no evidence of that.
And Richard, I'll throw that same question over to you. The evidence needs to be there for, I guess, this myriad of court cases that has been launched by the Trump team nationwide claiming voter fraud on a widespread scale and only in the states where he has lost. Is there any evidence to back it up at this point?
Well, at this point, no. And this is another great American tradition parallel to the election. Lawsuits for all sorts of reasons, and the Republican Party has decided to go ahead. It's mainly in the six major battleground states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, and the lawsuits are focusing on mailing votes, absentee ballots received counted days after the election. But as Linda explained, each state has its own rule, and in each cases, the ballots were counted according to the law. And so to go back to your question, Michael, even the lawsuits brought forwards by lawyers for the administration, not even an alleged widespread fraud. They are trying to play on small little things, but in the end, judges have stated the Republicans haven't provided valid evidence to back up assertions. And you see this repeating itself all over the state, counting absentee ballots. You know, in states like in Michigan, where initially Donald Trump had an advantage, which was reversed by absentee ballots. The Republicans claimed there was impropriety in the ballot counts, but they haven't been able to prove this. In Pennsylvania, it was the question of having observers who are not allowed, according to them, to watch the counting. This was disproved again. So, no, there's no proof, there's no evidence. Unfortunately, Donald Trump and at the moment people in his campaign continue repeating this unsubstantiated accusation, and the supporters of the president still seem to believe that something was wrong in all this.
And turning to supporters of the president, Linda, the president, to be fair and to give him his due, he does have a right to a fair vote count, to see that all the votes are counted. This is something any candidate would have those rights. And I think he's within his rights to suggest that and to insist on that. But there's a difference between that and, I guess, the insistence that the counted votes are actually, again, this sort of fraud and malfeasance. The question to you is, what is the end strategy for the president? Do you really think that he believes and is intending on turning over the results of this election? Or is this more of an attempt to set up a second act for him when he does leave office?
So Donald Trump is a fighter, and he never admits defeat. So the fact that he hasn't conceded the election is no surprise, although it's unprecedented in modern times. And a concession is just a nicety and a norm. It's not a legal requirement for the transition to take place. Although I think we'll get into where the legality of acknowledging the president-elect does become important. But what's really important here is what his followers believe. So what he's doing is chipping away at the credibility of this election, convincing his supporters that he was cheated, that the election was stolen. And we're seeing that in opinion polls. The Morning Consult poll taken in the past 3 days showed that 70%, 70, of Republicans believe that Donald Trump won the election. That's a problem. We want our American president, no matter who it is, to have at least the buy-in of the American public that they are the legitimate president. So when Joe Biden takes office, which I'm confident he will do on January 20th, he's going to have his work cut out in bringing all Americans into not supporting him, but just believing that he's the legitimate president.
And Richard, Linda makes a great point in bringing up the fact that a lot of Americans are doubting the veracity of an American election, which seems to me to be a dangerous thing for American democracy. So you have the voters, but you have elected officials and officials within the administration who are firmly entrenched in the idea that the president did not lose the election, including U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, who has authorized federal prosecutors to investigate, quote, substantial allegations of voting irregularities in the election. This is a move that oversees a memo that I believe has stood for 40, 50 years within the department, maybe longer, not to become involved in federal election disputes unless and until there is some evidence of malfeasance or corruption or misdeeds. Is it even more of a problem when an entire party stakes its reputation on the fact that America can't hold a fair and legal election?
I would say yes, at large, but it's not that surprising that one party could challenge the success of the other one. What is more troubling is the fact that you're talking about William Barr, the Attorney General. So William Barr doing this while the election hasn't been certified yet, and there hasn't been any serious proof of voting irregularities, the simple fact that the main prosecutor for election crime within the Department of Justice has decided that this deserved his resignation, he could not live with this, is a sign that there's something uncomfortable with this. So I see two things to answer your question, Michael. There's this Department of Justice position, and on the other side, the Republican Party. Yes, it unfortunately, it's obviously not good for political life in the United States when one party has this attitude. I do believe, however, that the Republicans, and I see this when I talk to people responsible of different aspects in the party, they understand the 70 plus million votes they got this election, while polls and all sorts of analysis before the election gave the impression that Americans were profoundly unsatisfied with this president, shows that the president still has a lot of influence within the Republican conservative electorate. So there's still two Senate election in Georgia. He has his grip on this electorate turning against the president at this very moment, so early after the election. I think it's very tough for Republicans. And that's, I think that's the reason why we're still seeing them, you know, dancing around the whole thing. They see this as the best way for them, considering that the influence it still carries with the Republican voters.
And Linda, let me give you another question, actually. How much of this is about the election of 2020, and how much of the refusal of top Republicans to accept the results, the beginning of the 2024 election, with people positioning themselves with that Republican base that we can call the Trump base?
So a lot of this is positioning for 2024, but we have an immediate crisis, which is that the president, we don't know what he thinks. Right? So he says things. He says things that seem off the wall. We can make some presumptions that he will leave office on January 20th. People around him who are saying things that sound sort of detached from reality, we don't know what they're actually thinking. We know what they're saying. So say William Barr, who has authorized federal prosecutors to investigate, quote, substantial allegations of voting irregularities. This may be William Barr trying to kind of help Donald Trump psychologically, ease him into losing. Donald Trump will never admit that he's lost the election, but we need him to behave in such a way that doesn't result in violence or something at a minimum deeply embarrassing to America's image. So we're hearing privately comments from Republican, top Republicans that yes, they believe Joe Biden won, but they don't want to say that publicly. A, they don't want to anger Trump's base, which is their base, their political base, but they also, they're trying to help Donald Trump in a way.
With that, we'll go to break and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Let's go on to President Donald Trump firing U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper this past Monday on Twitter, with several other key officials at the Defense Department, which employs some 2 million people around the world, including, of course, the armed forces. Even more worrisome is the fact that the incoming staff to replace the fired officials have been called by some to be political partisans who are unprepared and not competent for the positions they are taking. Richard, I'll start with you. Who got fired, and how does it affect the security and stability of the United States during this transition period?
You know, we read that there were tensions between the two men. Never a very easy relationship, but it was tension mainly after Mark Esper refused to use the troops, use the National Guard to crush the protesters this summer against police brutality and racial injustice. So there's a dynamic in there that's frightening from the start, which is the president wanted this to happen. It did not happen. Afterwards, his relationship with his own Secretary of Defense was bad. For Americans looking at their president and the Pentagon, it's kind of scary. But then looking out, you wonder the kind of respect and stability needed. I'm not personally surprised after 4 years of Donald Trump criticizing what he calls the deep state for undermining his administration and the decisions he wanted to bring forward, that he will try to play this game now and bring into the system supporters of his. I believe, I'm not sure, because I do think that they're extremely competent and patriotic officers and civil servants in the system to make sure that the United States still has a very coherent strategy and policy. But I think it just brings us again to the attitude of the president, who's always claimed that he was undermined for 4 years in doing what he wanted to do.
So again, victimized.
Yes.
Linda, I'm going to put you inside of the mind of the president and ask you, what are the true motivations for the firings, do we think? And what actually does President Trump want to happen at the Pentagon in the next 7 weeks when he hires these people who are clearly political allies of him, some of whom have worked for other political allies? What is afoot here? What does he expect to happen?
I honestly don't know. There are people who think that he's kind of positioning things for some kind of coup. Whether he thinks that or not, I don't know. I mean, you can argue both sides of that. You can argue that Donald Trump actually doesn't really like being president and that he is perfectly happy to leave, but he has to leave with his dignity or his own sense of dignity, which is to claim that he was robbed and that he should really be rightful president. There's also the issue of him facing lawsuits. So he might pardon himself before he leaves office. So he may not have to worry about any kind of legal exposure, but in the state of New York, he does face lawsuits, so there's that. This idea of him firing the civilian leaders of the Pentagon to position himself to kind of take over the country is frankly laughable. On Veterans Day in the United States, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, spoke at the opening of the National Museum of the Army, and he said, "We do not take an oath to an individual. We take an oath to the Constitution. Every federal employee takes an oath to the Constitution." And this idea that somehow the National Guard and all kinds of other military in this country are going to somehow back Donald Trump if he tries to stay in office beyond January 20th is just not happening. So the leadership around him, letting him do what he's allowed to do legally. I mean, he has the power of the presidency until he leaves office. So he can fire all these people. And we expect possibly more firings to come. You know, the head of the CIA may go, the head of the FBI. Donald Trump is allowed to do that. But all this will do is make Joe Biden's job more rich when he takes office in January. He'll have all kinds of personnel moves to handle.
And so since you did such yeoman work inside of Donald Trump's head, I'll give you a little bit easier one. Linda, what's been the response from Democrats and Republicans on the Hill about these firings? Has anyone pushed back? Have we had any response from either party's leaders?
Well, the Democrats, of course, are furious and pushing back as hard as they can, as to be expected. On the Republican side, a few members have congratulated Joe Biden on winning the election. The usual suspects, people like Mitt Romney, Senator from Utah, prominent Republican Susan Collins from Maine, who just won re-election. Off the record, you'll hear members, Republicans, saying, yes, they know Joe Biden's the next president, but they just can't speak publicly. And you even have, say, Senator Lankford from Oklahoma, who is a Republican and is saying that he's willing to help the incoming Biden team with intelligence and with getting read into what they need to know to take over the government.
It is truly, again, an extraordinary time. It's very difficult for people to come up with responses to this because there's no playbook, I think, for this at this time. We're really all sort of playing it by ear, and it is quite the balancing act that we're having between the two administrations. For the sake of time, I do want to sort of combine now the last two topics that we had, which are the Biden transition and COVID-19, because I think that for now, it looks like at least the beginning of the Biden administration is going to be defined by COVID-19, just as the entire second half of Donald Trump's administration was defined by his response to COVID-19. We have a declaration and a promise by Joe Biden that he will set up a task force that will deal directly with COVID-19, that he will rely on the science. We have a new chief of staff, Ron Klain, who's a longtime associate of Joe Biden, who also handled the Ebola crisis in the United States. So he is very, very seasoned in handling this particular thing, as well as being a skilled hand with across all the levers of power in Washington, D.C. When you combine the two, this transition is going to be about, it seems, hitting the ground running and getting this pandemic under control, where we're hitting record virus numbers on a daily basis, 140,000, I believe, yesterday, and expected to exceed that today in the days to come. Go back to you, Richard. How bad is the outbreak looking to experts right now in the United States? And how key is it for the Biden administration to come in and be able to convince the United States to get on one national plan to defeat the virus?
The outbreak looks very bad. We expected something like this. We had been told by the experts that come colder weather, people staying inside more, it was going to happen. And now we're seeing a strong second wave. The only good thing in all this is that at least we saw the first one. We're a little better organized, But the explosion in cases and hospitalizations, the increase, unfortunately, of the number of people dying of COVID is scary, because there's also this COVID fatigue, and it's harder to convince people to avoid getting together, to wear a mask. So when I hear what we heard this week from Biden, focusing Monday, for instance, on this task force, but also the pandemic itself, the necessity of wearing masks, to me, it's inspiring in the sense that, contrary to the attitude, unfortunately, of President Trump, who claimed that the media were talking about COVID just to undermine his reelection, and after the election, we wouldn't talk about it. On the contrary, the facts are there. This election has been the pandemic election. The mail-in ballots, the mail-in votes, all the changes, all this is linked to the fact that people reorganized their lives to vote. And in the end, this difficulty to get out of the election with a final decision comes out of the pandemic. So I think Joe Biden understands very well that the very main thing you will have to face and fight is this pandemic. And the fact that he was talking about Obamacare and health care coverage and protecting and expanding the coverage is also part of this idea, this impression giving to the Americans that their health is centered to this new administration. And it's a good message, I believe, at this very moment in the U.S.
Linda, the entire transition, it is partly about COVID-19, obviously, but it's about many other things. And again, the Biden transition is being denied access to resources, denied access to personnel, even to translators for the many calls that are coming in from international leaders congratulating and wanting to get started in their transition process with the incoming administration. They're being denied access to translators. Some Republicans, some senators, James Lankford, Marco Rubio, Mitt Romney, are calling for the administration to accept and assist the election transition. This transition, is there anything that anyone can legally do to force the president to assist the transition? And if they don't, how dangerous is that?
Right. So what's happened is sort of an obscure government administrator, the head of the General Services Administration, which is in charge of federal buildings, she has declined to sign something called an ascertainment, which doesn't concede the election. All it does is say that there is an apparent election winner in Joe Biden, and then that would open up these resources to him, allow him to send teams into the government agencies to be read in, give them more access to classified information, and release funds. So what we know about the Biden campaign is that they saw this coming. They figured that Trump would not cooperate with a transition if Biden won the election. So they're working around this blockage as best they can. They can raise their own money, so money's not a problem. They can talk to people who are outside the government. So the Biden team is strictly banning its personnel from communicating with people currently working in the administration. So just as an example, Mark Esper, until the other day, the defense secretary, he's now a private citizen. And if the Biden team wanted to talk to him, there's nothing preventing them from doing that. I'm not saying that's happening, but that's just an example. There are a lot of very seasoned, experienced former officials out there here in Washington and around the country. And the Biden team is not without options. Having said all that, it is a problem that the Trump administration has not acknowledged the very likely result. And this does have potential damage. In 2000, when we had that very close election, that the Bush v. Gore election that wasn't decided until the middle of December of that year, the transition was delayed because the election outcome was truly unknown until the Supreme Court ruled. And less than 8 months later, we had the 9/11 attacks. In the 9/11 Commission report, they cited the delayed transition as contributing to the fact that the U.S. was unprepared for the attack. So when you get into issues of national security, this, I think, is where it really matters that the Trump administration is not acknowledging the very likely outcome of this election.
Sobering thoughts and memories. Glad that you brought that to our attention again, to remember that and what really is at stake with a peaceful and smooth transition from one administration to another. We don't really have time to talk about Hong Kong's pro-democracy lawmakers, but I will just say this, that if we are looking somewhere in this world for profiles and courage of people who are willing to stand up and fight for their democracy. You have some very, very courageous and shining examples there in Hong Kong, and I encourage you all to take a look at that story and be inspired by it, as I was. That is all the time we have. Thanks to our panelists, Richard Latendresse, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, more analysis of the 2020 U.S. election results and their implications for the U.S. political landscape. Our guest, Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, that's a prominent policy group here in Washington. She is also the director of the Center for Effective Public Management at Brookings. Elaine Kmark specializes in American electoral politics and government innovation and reform in the United States and abroad. She was last at these VOA microphones back in March of this year during the Democratic primaries. Since then, not only did former Vice President Joe Biden emerge as the Democrats' choice for nominee among about 18 or so contenders, he has since been projected the winner of the November 2020 election. Notwithstanding U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to recognize these results, even though President-elect Biden has garnered more than 270 electoral college votes needed to win the presidency, this has not prevented Mr. Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, the first woman of color, and the first Asian American to be elected to the second highest office in the land, from forging ahead with transition efforts. According to VOA's Ken Bredemeyer and Catherine Gibson, quote, key Republican leaders in Washington are siding with President Donald Trump and his uphill legal battle to show that vote counting fraud is widespread enough to overturn the projected presidential election victory of Democrat Joe Biden, unquote. After attempting to verify Mr. Trump's claims of electoral fraud regarding mail-in ballots, the New York Times reported this week that no evidence of any major voting issues has emerged. New York Times reporters contacted electoral officials in all 50 states. In addition, election attorneys say that it is highly unlikely that any lawsuits will affect the outcome of the election. They add that recounts planned in some states are also unlikely to change the outcome. Well, we'll talk with Elaine Kmark, who is also a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and member of the Democratic National Committee, about these and other developments like down ballot races. We will ask her why the Democrats lost seats in the House of Representatives, even though they maintained their majority. We will also look at the balance of power in the Senate, which depends on the outcome of two high-stakes runoff elections in the southern state of Georgia in early January 2021. Elaine Kmark, the author of many books, including Primary Politics, Everything You Want to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates, joins us via Microsoft Teams. Elaine, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
And as a longtime Democratic activist, Elaine Kmark, what's your assessment of the 2020 U.S. election results that have projected that former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris are now President-elect and Vice President-elect of the United States of America?
Well, I think it's two things. Obviously, Democrats like myself are very, very happy that the Trump era has come to an end. We're pleased with the breadth of Joe Biden's win. He's got a significant Electoral College victory and a significant victory in the popular vote. But we were kind of artificially buoyed by the early polls. And I think a lot of Democrats, myself included, expected that there would be more change in the down ballot races, that there would be a pickup in the House of Representatives. Instead, there was a loss. And we even dreamed of getting the United States Senate, which could still happen, but it's really, really, really close. And as you indicated in your introduction, it depends on two Senate races in Georgia. So we're happy, we're relieved, but our expectations were higher. And I think some of our expectations have been dashed.
Well, we'll talk about some of those down ballot races and why there is this discrepancy between reality and hopes. But what about the turnout? I mean, this was a high voter turnout in the midst of a pandemic, even as President Trump and Republicans were trying to delegitimize mail-in ballots and even hamstringing the U.S. Postal Service. What does that say about the electorate and their interest in this election?
It was a very highly mobilized electorate. On both sides, I mean, President Trump's voters really turned out. I mean, and they turned out on Election Day just exactly as he had asked them to do. Joe Biden's voters turned out in mail ballots. Lots and lots of ballots came in early. Every state broke records for the number of mail-in ballots. And that was, of course, a function of the pandemic and people not wanting to go out to polling places, to places where they'd be with strangers. And so this was a huge turnout on both sides. And the numbers aren't really in yet, but we may have the highest turnout in a century in American politics as a percentage of eligible voters.
And speaking of the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots, just as Mr. Trump and many Republicans were telegraphing in the run-up to the election, they seem to want to somehow undermine mail-in ballots, saying somehow even in the midst of a pandemic, they were illegitimate, even though we know Mr. Trump votes by absentee ballot. Nonetheless, what do you make now of President Trump's refusal to recognize the results, which are quite decisive, as you said, in terms of the Electoral College, which may even increase, that is, Mr. Biden's numbers of Electoral College votes are likely to increase in some states. And that is, of course, what determines the presidency, as well as Mr. Biden's decisive national popular vote, which is, again, growing in Pennsylvania, in Georgia, and even in Arizona and Nevada. What do you make of the refusal to recognize these results?
Well, it's, again, one of the kind of mysterious things that this president has done. It's not surprising. This president has defied conventional wisdom from the very beginning. He marches to his own drummer. He doesn't seem to have any interest in respecting the norms of democracy that other presidents have had. He views conspiracy theories all over the place. And he is particularly skeptical about elections. So in 2016, when he was winning Republican primaries, he was totally skeptical and saying the system was rigged, which people were sort of scratching their heads and saying, but you're winning. In 2016, in the fall, when he was in the general election, he persisted in saying that the system was rigged and that he would not concede if Hillary Clinton won the election. Again, it was like with no evidence, just sowing mistrust all over the place in order to protect himself and his ego should he lose. There's a little bit of odd psychology going on here, and I almost never talk about psychology in the midst of politics, but Donald Trump, remember, hates losers. The worst thing he can say about somebody is they're a loser, and he's always calling his enemies losers, whether they're in the press or other politicians. He's totally disrespectful. Psychologically, he can't admit that he has lost. And so he's going to have to play out every last possibility. He's going to believe in every conspiracy theory, no matter how vague the evidence, because this is going to be a hard thing for him psychologically to take into account. If we look at other presidents who've lost in close races, look at Al Gore, the grace with which Al Gore conceded after the Supreme Court ruled against him in December of 2000. Most politicians have enough self-security in their own personalities to say, okay, well, I did everything I could, I lost. For Donald Trump, this is a very difficult thing to do. So a lot of what we're seeing is him just playing out something that he needs to play out. And a lot of people going along with him, understanding that, yeah, he needs to do this and eventually it will stop.
So tell us when you think it will stop, and what are the implications of President Trump and many Republican lawmakers not recognizing President-elect Biden's victory, and how that is going to affect this important interregnum, the transition to January 20th?
Well, my guess is that it will stop on December 14th. December 14th is the day in the Constitution when the Electoral College meets. Now, this bizarre system goes as follows. The electors for the winner in each state meet in the state capitol, and they sign what's called a certificate of ascertainment, which is a quaint 18th century term, saying that they, as an elector, vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. Those get sent into Washington, D.C. There's actual paper that does go, and to the United States Senate, and the president of the Senate announces this on January 6th. When those Electoral College meetings take place on December 14th, we can assume, for a variety of reasons, which I can get into later, we can assume that the winner of the state has won the Electoral College and that the Democratic or the Republican electors have signed the certificate and sent it on. At that point, it's really over, okay? At that point, there's a process in the Constitution for the Senate to meet and open the ballots and formally declare the president the president. But at that point, it will be hard to pretend that Donald Trump has won. And so let's look at what that means for this transition period. Usually, a losing presidential candidate concedes. They may not concede right away, particularly if there's votes being counted, et cetera, but they do concede and give a concession speech. When that happens, usually the head of the Government Services Administration, GSA, goes ahead and says, okay, the transition has begun, and releases $6.3 million to the winner for transition activities. Now, that's not an awful lot of money for a big country. Usually what it goes to pay for is office space and telephones and things like that. Well, as you can see from behind me, we're all working at home. Nobody's in their offices anyway. We're in the middle of a pandemic. So it's certainly not going to impede the progress of a Biden transition that they are not in an office together. I suspect you'll see Joe Biden doing a lot of Zoom calls with, you know, prospects for his cabinet. I wouldn't be surprised if he was doing it now. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the official transition provides for the winner to send teams into the government agencies to get briefed on, you know, what's going on. Well, on the domestic side of the ledger, and that includes dealing with the pandemic, you know, Joe Biden doesn't really need to get into the agencies. I mean, there's no secrets in those agencies. The Center for Disease Control publishes information on COVID infections on a regular basis. So do the other agencies. The guidelines for when we get allow for a vaccine to be distributed are public at the Food and Drug Administration. So it's not going to really affect Joe Biden. And in fact, he's proceeding quickly to draw up a COVID plan for when he takes office. The third area is the one where there could be some problem, which is on the national security side. The president-elect, Joe Biden, is not getting the president's top secret briefings, nor is his national security team being able to proceed getting their security clearances so that they can be read into sensitive intelligence. So that is a potential problem and cause for concern, which is that they may be behind a bit in catching up with the, you know, various brewing crises around the world that we may or may not know about. So that is a problem. But basically, the delay, which will probably be slightly more than a month before we do a formal transition, isn't really slowing down Joe Biden. He's giving press conferences, he's meeting with teams, he's looking at personnel. he's proceeding with the transition.
Exactly. And he's received many congratulatory phone calls from world leaders.
Oh, yeah. You know, usually you need the State Department to set those up. There's a certain protocol, et cetera. I'm sure they're following that protocol because his foreign policy team has been in the State Department and they're quite experienced. And he's talking to world leaders. He's talking to potential cabinet secretaries. He's planning all the regulations he's going to reverse that Trump put in. And I'm sure Biden will sign a whole raft of executive orders reversing regulations very, very quickly. So he's doing the work.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Elaine Kmark, founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management and senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. And she joins us via Microsoft Teams as we all continue to practice social distancing during this coronavirus pandemic. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a big shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Kashia Johanna from Kaduna, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our special guest, Elaine Kmark. And Elaine, talking about President-elect Biden's enormous experience as both a vice president and a senator, he really knows how government works. He's, as you said, going forward with his transition, as is Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Talk about the meaning of the historic significance of Kamala Harris as vice president-elect. She's a woman, as we said, a woman of color, of Indian descent. You know, you wrote an interesting article back in August entitled, "This is Not Your Grandfather's Vice Presidency." And this was, of course, before she was elected. Discuss the historic significance and how the office of the vice president has changed in the past 30 years.
Well, it used to be that vice presidents were chosen in a nominating convention before the era of primaries. And what often happened in the old days, and I'm talking pre-1972, is that a leading candidate would need votes to get over the top, over 50% or two-thirds, depending on the rule at the time. And that leading candidate would look around for things to bargain with. And of course, the biggest bargaining chip was offering somebody the vice presidency in return for the votes of their delegates. Now, practically, what that meant was oftentimes the president was choosing a vice president from a different region of the country or a different faction of the party or both, which meant that for much of our history, we had some pretty dysfunctional pairs of presidents and vice presidents. We had presidents and vice presidents who didn't like each other and in fact weren't politically on the same page and in fact spent their time undermining each other. And some of those stories are pretty funny. They're in my book, Picking the Vice President. That all changed in 1972 when we started picking presidents through primaries. And the result was that presidents, particularly beginning in 1992 with Bill Clinton's selection of Al Gore, stopped picking vice presidents to balance the ticket. And so they started picking vice presidents who were in tune with them ideologically, who were from a part of the country, regardless of whether they needed that part of the country for the ticket or not. Look at Joe Biden's own selection. He was from Delaware. Delaware has all of 3 electoral votes. It's one of the smallest states in the country. It's reliably Democratic. Obama didn't need Joe Biden for political purposes. He did need Joe Biden because Joe Biden had extensive foreign policy experience, particularly in Iraq and Iran and those conflicts, and he wanted him to help him. So that model is now a more of a partnership model than it is a political balance model. And I think what we saw with Biden was there was a little bit of the balance model just because women are so much more supportive of the Democratic Party than men are. It was pretty clear all year long that there would be a woman on the Democratic ticket. And then after that, it boiled down to a question of race. Could you find a woman of color to also give more of that political balance, but also just plain old compatibility? Is this person somebody that Joe Biden can trust? And is it a person who is more or less ideologically attuned to Joe Biden? And the reason that latter is so important is that modern vice presidents take on big responsibilities themselves, independent of the president. So Al Gore ran Reinventing Government, and he ran the telecommunications reform, which is a big deal. And the president simply said, whatever Al thinks, that's what we're going to do. But it can only happen if the president trusts the vice president and picks somebody with whom they are very comfortable. So I think that's how Joe Biden arrived at Kamala Harris. It was safe for Biden to say early on, as he did, that he was going to choose a woman, because we now have a sufficient number of women in the Senate, in governor's offices, that you can't argue about their experience. But I think that beyond that, it turns into a question of trust and personality, and who do you want to have as your partner doing a very, very difficult job.
So let's turn now to the Congress. Elaine Kmark, the blue wave that many Democrats were hoping for didn't actually materialize. Instead of gaining seats in the lower chamber of the House of Representatives, they lost a few seats. Now in the Senate, the Democrats didn't win a couple of endangered Republican seats, like that of Maine Senator Susan Collins. She kept her seat. Joni Ernst of Iowa, they were hoping to snatch those two, but they didn't. Right now, as we said, the balance of power in the Senate depends on these two runoff races in Georgia. But I'd like to get your take on what chances do the Democrats have. Georgia is leaning Democratic right now. Joe Biden may be declared the winner in Georgia. Explain first this discrepancy between Democrats' aspirations and realities.
My take is that there were a lot of sort of swing voters, Republicans, who were kind of disgusted with President Trump, who is not always what we think a president should be and doesn't act like a president often. And yet they were very wary of the Democratic Party, and particularly the left wing of the Democratic Party. Particularly two terms were quite frightening to them. Socialist. America has never been big on socialism, even though I know that many other countries are. Socialism here is a bad word, not quite as bad as communism, but almost as bad. And this funny term, which still bothers me that they used it, called defund the police. When you look at what Black leaders were actually talking about, they were really talking about taking functions away from the police that were not related to crime and stopping crime and giving them to other places. For instance, in all American cities, the police have the job of getting a homeless person who's perhaps sitting in the middle of a sidewalk and is kind of shouting at people, et cetera, but it's not a crime he's committing, but the police have to go deal with that person. And they're saying maybe the police should just worry about crime and order, and we should have other agencies worrying about, for instance, homelessness. And so that's what it meant when you talk to them. But this terrible terminology of defund the police led people to think, oh my God, when somebody's breaking in my window over here, nobody's going to come because they're going to take all the money away from the police. It was just awful. The left in America really needs to learn how to talk to the rest of America, because all they do is scare the living daylights out of them.
That may be true, but on the other hand, analysts say the Republicans exploited the term socialist, although people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's a liberal Democrat from New York, of course, Bernie Sanders, the senator, even though they claim this so-called democratic socialist label, it has no resemblance to the socialism of, let's say, Venezuela or Cuba. But I think that the Republicans conflated those very successfully.
But remember that that is a subtlety that most voters don't get. The difference between democratic socialism and socialism, it's way too subtle a distinction to make. Therefore, it was easy for the Republicans to do this. And every time somebody on the left tried to defend democratic socialism, all people saw was they were defending socialism. In politics, you just can't make those fine distinctions. And defund the police was another one that really hurt Democratic candidates in swing districts. I think a lot of Republicans said to themselves, okay, I can't vote for this guy Trump, but I want to make sure that the left wing of the Democratic Party is checked. And that's why I think that Democrats lost House seats and really haven't gotten very far in the Senate.
What about these two Senate races in Georgia? Do you think the Democrats have a chance of winning those seats? And what does that imply for the Senate?
They might be able to pick up one, okay? And then that would make it a very, very close Senate. I think it might be like a 49-51 Senate. And then we'll be in a situation where the question will be on critical issues. Are there enough Republican senators who will bolt, especially with Donald Trump no longer in office, and occasionally support the Democrats? There are four senators that have already called to congratulate Joe Biden and who have said that they think it's wrong what Trump is doing. And you can look at those four in a very closely divided Senate and say, well, you know, maybe there's a possibility that on some issues there could be bipartisan coalitions made. And that is, I think, a tricky thing to do. But Joe Biden spent a lot of years in the Senate. So if there's anybody that could pull this off, it's probably Joe Biden.
So let's say the Republicans prevail, as you said, perhaps getting one of the two runoffs in January. That means Mitch McConnell returns as majority leader. Do you think it portends more gridlock, and would it stymie President-elect Biden's domestic agenda? Or, as you alluded to, would Biden's relationship, very strong relationship with the Senate, with Republican senators, Mitch McConnell in particular, could that help prevent this type of gridlock? Would Mr. McConnell be more collaborative somehow behind the scenes? Would he be more likely to compromise?
Oh, I think for sure. I think actually, ironically, we've already seen some hints of that. Prior to the election, they were not going to give any state and local government relief in a COVID bill. Not going to do it. Suddenly, the day after election, Mitch McConnell says, yes, possibly we would have state and local relief in the bill. So I think we were already seeing it. And remember, a lot of this depends on what happens to Trump and the Trump voters, right? When Trump is no longer in the Oval Office, things will change. I think he'll still be a very powerful voice in American politics, but he will not have that incredible bully pulpit that the presidency is. So remains to be seen how Republican senators especially will view opportunities for compromise. There may be enough of them that we will have some compromise on some issues.
And as we close, Elaine Paymark, let me ask you about December 14th one more time. To what extent you think that will be a critical date after which those who have refused to recognize the 2020 U.S. election results will sort of say, okay, because the electors are certifying the election. Do you think there might be still any chance for any type of manipulation whatsoever? And then finally, how do you think our electoral infrastructure fared, especially during this election, the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots? Many analysts are saying, hooray to our election workers, the election officials in all the states, that they have done yeoman work and that it shows that, you know, our electoral infrastructure, notwithstanding many shortcomings, it has proven to be quite solid and credible.
On the first point, it will be very difficult after December 14th to say that Donald Trump won the election. I mean, almost impossible. I'm sure there will be some hardcore Trump supporters who will continue to insist that it was stolen. But the end is there. I mean, that is the end of this process, is when those electors sign their certificates and send them on to the Senate. In terms of the election administration, it's remarkable. One of the remarkable things is what a small percentage of ballots were messed up. I myself said, oh, lots of people will be voting absentee for the first time, and therefore they're going to make mistakes on their ballots. There's going to be ballots that are set aside as provisional or will have to be sent back. In fact, that number is very small, and election officials have been surprised at it. In addition, states were worried about the post office delaying election mail because of the shenanigans of President Trump's postmaster general. So people really mailed in their ballots ahead of time. And so in Pennsylvania, even if all the ballots that arrived after Election Day are thrown out by a court, It still isn't enough to make any difference in Joe Biden's majority, and he'll still win the state of Pennsylvania. So we're very pleased. In addition, we did not see Russian or international intervention in this election, in the election apparatus. There was plenty of disinformation, et cetera. It's a little hard to separate the domestic disinformation from the international disinformation. But in terms of penetrating election systems, they seem to have learned the lesson from 2016. The states seem to be ready and up to the job.
Elaine Kmark is senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution and author of the acclaimed book, Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, thank you again for sharing your insights, this time about the results of the 2020 election and, of course, their ramifications for our political landscape.
Thanks so much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
VOA News via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman.